Again, this call is being recorded. If you do not wish to be recorded, you may disconnect at any time. If you would like to speak, you can virtually raise your hand by pressing five star on your dial pad. You will then be called upon in the order that your hand was raised. Again, that's five star on your dial pad. Please take a moment to enter your speaker code if you've not already done so. Also, please remember to mute your phone until speaking. Good afternoon and welcome to a duly noticed meeting for the Stakeholder Advisory Board to the Governor's Office of Emergency Relief and Recovery. The Governor's Office for Emergency Relief and Recovery was created when Governor Sununu issued Executive Order 2020-06. That order is publicly available on the Governor's website. Today's meeting is an official meeting of the Board, is open to the public, and will be run in a manner compliant with RSA 91A. We have someone on the phone taking minutes, which will be posted to the Gopher webpage. Meeting materials for the Board and the public can be found by visiting the Gopher webpage at www.goferr.nh.gov. Again, that's gopher.nh.gov. And again, today's meeting is being recorded. I will help facilitate today's meeting. Because the Board is meeting by phone, under RSA 91A, there are a few initial logistics that we need before I turn it over to our Chair, Donnelly Loza. First, each of us must state our name, where we are located, and who is with us. As we move through our agenda today, each Board member and anyone else speaking is asked to identify themselves before speaking. Should you choose to take any votes today, they must be done by roll call. We will now proceed with the attendance roll call, and I'll begin with myself and the folks here in the office with me. I am Joe Dorian, Deputy Director of the Gopher in the Gopher office, 1 Eagle Square in Concord. I'm appropriately socially distanced at a large conference room table with
Rhonda Hensley,
Nancy Smith,
Sean Thomas,
John Frazier,
Frank Frederick,
Lisa English.
Thank you. Now we'll proceed with Board member roll calls, alphabetically. Bill Ardinger.
Yes, this is Bill Ardinger. I'm here in Cuddyhunk, and I'm got family around, but by myself right now.
Perfect. Thank you, Bill. Dean Kristen.
Good afternoon. This is Dean Kristen. I'm at my office in Bedford, and I am alone in the room.
Thank you, Dean. Lisa Drabik.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Lisa Drabik. I'm alone in my office at Londonderry Town Hall.
Thank you, Lisa. Jim Jalbert. Just checking, Jim has emailed Donnelly and I that he might be a little late to this afternoon's meeting. Amy LaBelle.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can.
Amy LaBelle, I'm at LaBelle Winery, and I am alone.
Thank you, Amy. Al Letizio Jr.
Hi, Joe. Hi, everyone. This is Al Letizio Jr. I am speaking to you from my car in Washington, D.C., and my wife, Patty, is with me, and she's the one hitting the mute button and unmute button safely as needed.
Okay. Thank you, Al. Donnelly Lozo.
Hi, Joe. This is Donnelly Lozo. I'm alone, and I'm at home today.
Thank you, Donnelly. Scott Mason.
This is Scott Mason. I'm in North Stratford. I'm at the farm office.
Thank you, Scott. Michelle McEwen.
Good afternoon. This is Michelle McEwen. I am alone in my office in Plymouth, New Hampshire.
Thank you, Michelle. Nancy Merrill. Just wanted to do one more check. Nancy, were you able to join us this afternoon? We will check back. Jeffrey Myers. And Mr. Myers mentioned that he might have to join a little later on, so we will check back. Holly Noveletsky.
This is Holly Noveletsky. Good afternoon. I am in my office in Greenland, New Hampshire, and I'm alone.
Thank you, Holly. Kathleen Reardon.
Hi, this is Kathleen Reardon. I'm in my home in New Boston alone.
Thank you, Kathleen. Benjamin Wilcox.
Hi, this is Ben Wilcox. I'm in my office in North Conway, and I am alone.
Thank you, Ben. And I just wanted to circle back in case if any other board members joined us. Jim Jalbert. Nancy Merrill. And Jeffrey Myers. And if you could hit 5-star, that would help us identify you in case if you had some technical difficulties logging in. Donna Lee, with the roll call completed, we are ready to continue, and we have a quorum.
Great. Thanks so much, Joe. Nice to hear everybody again. Hopefully you've had a little break through the summer so far. The purpose of today's meeting is we thought it might be time to just give everybody an update with all the programs that have launched about where things stand, and to give members an opportunity under other business to talk a little bit more about any experiences that they're having. So, Joe, I'll turn it back to you for the presentation, and should members have, it would be great if you could go a section at a time and then see if anybody has questions so that we're able to answer them as we go along. Well, you have A through E under presentation, so that might be a good time to do one at a time, as I said, and then let folks ask questions if they have any. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Donna Lee. Just wanted to start off with a quick website update. If you haven't had a chance to visit the website in a short time, a lot of content is added every day, and we're constantly adding more things, adapting. We want to make the experience more user-friendly. We understand that there's a lot of information, and rightfully so, right? I mean, we're working with $1.25 billion, so we want to make sure that, there's full transparency, that we're providing explanations, that we're accounting for the public funds, that we're making sure that folks understand what's going on and providing opportunities to interact with us, asking questions. So when you pull up the website, you'll see that it has completely changed. You'll see a lot of infographics. You'll find that we even have a chat bot there. So if you are unsure as to where to find things, you can actually type in a question, and it will try to help direct you there. So as a staff, it was kind of fun trying to think of all the different questions, and we utilized what questions we had received through our web inquiry form, but also emails and phone calls and whatnot, because we want to make sure that we are responsive to the public. You'll see the various tabs, for advisory boards. Feel free, you can see presentations, you can see information about the legislative advisory board and the stakeholder advisory board. For transparency, we have all the board members listed under the advisory board tab. If you click stakeholder advisory board, you can see the call information for the calls for the public. You can see, as I mentioned, the members of the board along with the disclosure documents. You can find a whole lot of information there for folks if anybody wanted to take a look there. And again, you have the legislative advisory board. We have news and meetings where you can find a way to contact the press office, the info ad account, the different public announcements, like when we notice meetings of the SAB and the lab. Those are found in news and meetings. The COVID expenditures tab, which there is a lot there, and we're going to provide here at Gopher some explanations for the various programs listed there. But if you click on any of them, you'll find a whole bunch of information about what those programs are and how they interact with the public and how they're meaning to address the COVID-19 pandemic. And then if you look at transparency, there's a whole bunch of drop-downs, including the Main Street Relief Fund's transparency map, and that's incredibly interactive and would encourage folks. I mean, that's our biggest program, and you can see town by town how money was distributed to different businesses. We were very clear with applicants that this is a public process. This is a transparent process. So we want folks to be able to see. So we plan on adding additional functionality of different programs in the future. So we're working with a number of entities, including the Department of Information Technology and various vendors to provide as much information as a web platform will allow. And then on the contact, just a way to get in touch with us through the online web inquiry. And, of course, we have the info at Gopher account. So we want to make sure that folks, if they need to get a hold of us, that we're accessible. So that's a brief overview of the tabs. I mean, we could probably do a whole meeting on just the content of the website. But a lot of hours, a lot of time is put into this because we want to have an outward-facing platform that shows what's going on for transparency, for good governance. And so we want folks to apply and participate in the different programs, and we're always encouraging participation throughout the whole process. So with that, Donna Lee, I don't know, I guess I could take a few questions on the website overview if people have them, or would you like me to go right into the overview of the announced programs, which I think most people are most excited about?
I think you're right. Most people are excited about what's next, but just in case there are questions on the website, I think we should give folks an opportunity. Does anybody have any questions?
That's a 5-star. Anybody has a question or comment?
The website is really very impressive, Joe. I know how much time people have had to put into it to have it look like this, so I think it's pretty great.
Donnelly, we apparently I did that great of an explanation.
Well, or the website speaks for itself too, Joe. All right. Well, I'm just throwing a little bone to the IT folks. All right.
Yeah.
Why don't you go on to item B? Thank you.
Perfect. So I'm going to turn it over for the first program that we're going to discuss. I'm going to turn it over to Lisa English. And Lisa is going to discuss the Connecting New Hampshire Emergency Broadband Expansion Program. Go ahead, Lisa.
Great. Thank you, Joe. So as many of you are aware, when New Hampshire entered into and our school districts entered into responding to this pandemic, there was a swift and successful transition to remote services. But there are areas with limited internet connectivity, and those areas certainly have experienced challenges with this transition. So the governor authorized the expenditure of $50 million from the CARES Act funds to address this increased need of internet connectivity because of the pandemic. And so that's led to the Connecting New Hampshire Emergency Broadband Expansion Program, which is designed to benefit students, families, businesses, as the need for distance learning, telework, telehealth, and other remote services continues as we make our way through this pandemic. The OSI, the Office of Strategic Initiatives, is working with the Department of Education and the PUC, the Public Utilities Commission, in an RFP process. That process actually is ongoing right now. The due date for the RFPs passed on July 2nd. So the anticipated contract awards is in mid-July. So we'll have more information about this program at that time. So that's all I have for my quick overview.
Don Lee, I know that was a very brief overview. I think folks will maybe have some questions. Could we take some questions about that specific program now? Is that okay, or would you like to hold questions at the end of the section or do it by program?
Well, I think if we do it by program, it would make it easier.
Perfect.
It might lengthen the meeting a little bit, but I think if something's on somebody's mind right then, it's easier than having them try to wait till the end. So
why don't we see if there's any questions regarding that? I mean, that one, I think Lisa's point is the bid went out, closed, now you have to look. But if anybody has questions on that, now's your chance.
Perfect. Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Michelle. Go ahead, Michelle.
Hi, yes, thank you. Just I wasn't quite sure if I heard this correctly or not. Because I'm representing healthcare and we did have to change to telehealth to be able to continue providing care to our patients, this you said was the public utilities working with the Department of Education, but I also thought I heard you said this could be a solution to telehealth. So I'm just trying to figure out how healthcare fits into this.
So thank you. That's a great question. The need for effective broadband connectivity is important, and we hear about it a lot when we're talking about schools going remote or businesses, but there are people that access their healthcare through this, and if they aren't able to have connectivity, they're really limited to just, for example, having a telephone call as opposed to potentially some sort of video mechanism. So that's really, when I talk about telehealth with regard to the broadband program, that is, that's really what we're talking about. There's no doubt that every program that we have, or most every program that we have that involves funding different organizations, is being used to fund a lot of different transitions into remote and telework work.
Okay, so this initiative would still allow for at least telehealth with the broadband.
So this is very specifically to increase connectivity. So it's for expanding access to broadband. And so,
okay.
So yeah, okay, great.
Great, thanks.
And again, star five for any questions. Oh, I'm sorry, five star. Goodness, it's a little rusty. Five star. And we have a question from Bill Artinger. Go ahead, Bill.
Hi, Joe, Gopher team, everybody. Good to hear all of you, and I hope everyone is doing okay in these challenging times. Lisa, my question to you about this program is about the complexity of getting this kind of infrastructure in place and how that interrelates with the requirement that the state must disperse the funds for the purpose by the end of the year. I'd just like you to address what the planning is on that.
So we made it very clear up front the challenges that are imposed essentially on these funds because of the guidance. And in fact, there's an FAQ directly on this point that talks about if you are going to use funds to expand broadband capacity, it has to be something that will increase capacity to a significant extent during the current public health emergency. So that in mind, we rolled out what is a pretty aggressive timeline, and it certainly is a challenge, but in order to take advantage of this opportunity, all expenditures under the program end on December 30th, and projects, the goal is for projects to be complete as early as possible and no later than December 15th.
So are you, follow up, please, and is that your, are you talking about making the expenditure for the purpose and then the funds can be deployed, you know, kind of in a sensible way to achieve the actual construction of the infrastructure over the next year, say? Or are you saying that the infrastructure, you're interpreting the Treasury guidance to say that the infrastructure itself has to be constructed and in service by 12/31.
That's correct. It's actually December 30th. So the projects under this program need to be complete during the time allowed by the FAQ. So it is an aggressive timeline, but it's the only way that we're able to use CARES Act funds for this purpose. And when I say CARES Act funds, I'm talking about the coronavirus relief fund or the Gopher fund.
Understood. I would just comment as follow-up that given the fact that it's a construction-type project, you know, I am concerned that that it's going to be very, very, it seems like the program is too constraining to achieve its goal. That is a very aggressive timeline, as you say. And, it, you know, in my experience, you know, where you have to lease up space on poles, you got to put up poles, you got to lay wires, you got to test it, you got to synchronize it. I think, you know, we had a prior program in the state that was not very, you know, it took forever. And so I just have a sense of caution. Do you think there's any chance that the federal government will understand that it's probably proposing a kind of silly, unrealistic limitation with respect to the broadband and maybe open that up a little bit? Thank you.
Thanks for the question. I have no doubt that there are people asking Congress to try and change these guardrails as far as the timing on the coronavirus relief fund. But so the time restraints we have on this program have been put upon us by the federal government. And so whether or not the efforts to try and change that time frame are successful or not, only Congress knows, which I think means no one probably knows for sure as we sit here today.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. And Donna Lee, it appears that we have no further hands raised on this particular program.
Okay, great. We'll go to the next one. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you. And we're going to stick with Lisa. So Lisa is going to now chat about the long-term care stabilization program. Go ahead, Lisa.
Thank you, Joe. So this program actually began prior to the opening of the Gopher office. It was developed with DHHS and New Hampshire Employment Security. And this, the COVID-19 long-term care stabilization program was designed to help stabilize the frontline work of certain Medicaid providers that are not able to do their work remotely. And it's targeted to providers that support aging seniors and people with developmental disabilities, as well as individuals with mental health and substance abuse disorders. There's also, I believe, youth residential treatment providers and developmental disability service providers who provide residential or community home-based care. So the program has, as I understand it, has been successful in incentivizing frontline workers to either remain or rejoin this crucial workforce during the COVID-19 emergency. So this was originally set to expire on June 30th, but it's been extended to July 31st. To align with the unemployment, the enhanced unemployment benefits related to COVID-19. And at this point, there have been, I believe, over 20,000 workers that have received stipends, and I believe approximately over $35 million have been spent in this program.
Okay. Happy to take the questions with a 5-star. And 5-star to ask a question about the long-term care stabilization program. Donna Lee, seeing none, is it okay if we proceed to the next program or?
Each time you present, Joe, why don't you ask if there are questions just the way you've done, and if not, go ahead and feel free to move on to the next one.
Understood. Perfect.
Thank you.
Great. We will now proceed to the healthcare system relief fund, and that's in several components, and I will pass it off to Nancy Smith. Go ahead, Nancy.
Good afternoon. The first part of the Health Care System Relief Fund, which we refer to as Round 1, again started before the Gopher office was established. That was one of the first funds that the governor set up. It was originally set up with state funds, $50,000 in $50 million in state funds, and the a committee was formed at DHHS to administer those funds. They accepted applications, and those initial funds were it was decided to go through those applications and to prioritize what they felt were frontline workers, frontline facilities that were in danger of closing due to impacts of the pandemic. So the awards or grants made to those entities that were frontline based on in that round one were done as loans, no interest loans, which are maybe forgivable. And we haven't gotten to that phase yet, but down the road, now that these are being backfilled with gopher funds, we will be looking at whether we have enough information to do forgiveness on those loans from round one. So the entities that receive those loans are all up on our website, so I'm not going to go through those in detail. We did go on to round two under the Healthcare System Relief Fund, and the governor added $50 million to the initial $50 million, so there was $100 million total for the Healthcare System Relief Fund. $30 million of that he did request be set aside for long-term care providers because of the impact of the pandemic on the elderly in long-term care facilities. So there have been an additional 8 substantial grants to hospitals who weren't in the first round of frontline awards. Those 8 hospital grants total $24,915,000. Those awards were announced a week ago, a couple weeks ago. Actually, I guess it was just last week. We got the grants out at the beginning of this week, and we're getting them back signed now, so those checks will be going out very shortly. That was to an 8 additional hospitals that had not previously received funds. There were 2 more processes that we've gone through. One was for long-term care. That we had an application process. We received 89 applications for long-term care. In reviewing those, on the surface of the information in the applications, we were able to make 68 awards for a total of, I believe the long-term care awards that we've been able to make so far totaled approximately $11 million. I think it's a little bit under that. But that was for the long-term care so far. On the healthcare applicants that had not been considered but had submitted applications in the first round, they weren't considered because they weren't frontline. We asked them to submit supplemental applications. We got 152 of those. Of those, again, on that initial review, we were able to make 107 additional awards for an additional approximately $8 million. And so what we are doing to finish up that round two is review the about 20 applications from both long-term care and the healthcare providers that we have not been able to make awards to see whether their detailed supporting data is sufficient to make an award. And then there'll be further evaluation of that fund as to what we have spent from it after that to see whether we do another round at that point.
Great. Thank you, Nancy. Five star to ask a question. Again, that's 5 star to ask a question. And we have the first question from Kathleen Reardon. Go ahead, Kathleen.
Hi, Nancy. I have a question. I'm just a little confused by by your presentation and what is on the website, because it talks about an updated application being available soon, but it sounded like, if I understand correctly, that the round two applications were really the ones that were not funded in the initial. So my question really is around the kinds of facilities that are receiving funds and sort of how broadly this healthcare system relief fund is conceived. You had talked about the first phase was really about organizations that were in imminent danger of closure. And then I believe that there was a concept that it would be expanded to all different types of healthcare related entities, not just those facilities. But I'm not really clear if that's exactly how it has played out.
So, if I...
Meaning?
The all long-term care facilities were received notice that their opportunity to submit an application for the broader category of healthcare providers, the notice for the supplemental application, the decision was made that this round was only going to be open to those that had not been considered as frontline providers. Like I said, the decision was to get updated information specifically for a grant process from those before we go on to any other broader application process, which would be open again to all healthcare providers. So
okay.
That broad-based application has not happened yet.
Okay, that's helpful. But can I just make sure I understand this? So the first round was healthcare facilities that were in danger of closing, and that was the main criteria. This next round were those that maybe had submitted, in addition to the long care stabilizations, but there were other healthcare facilities. And then if there's another different criteria and broader healthcare entities, that's future. Did I capture that accurately?
That's essentially correct, although there was no limitation on who could apply in the first healthcare round, the applications that were received, it was decided to prioritize those and just consider those that were considered frontline from that. That was not a criteria or a limitation on who could apply. So any healthcare provider could have applied in round one.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Great. And again, that's 5-star to ask a question. And I'm just checking the board right now. Again, that's 5-star. Give another moment to populate if anybody would like to raise their hand to ask a question. Okay, great. Well, thank you, Nancy. We're going to shift gears and now chat about the Main Street Relief Fund, and that has two components that we're going to chat about, which is the Main Street Relief Fund and the New Hampshire Self-Employed Livelihood Fund, or SELF program, and I'll turn that over to Sean. Go ahead, Sean.
Thank you, Joe. The Main Street Relief Fund received over 8,700 final submissions. As of this week, DRA has processed 5,246 awards. They had processed over 5,000 as of the week of June 22nd. So right now, those additional awards are the result of pending appeals as well as DRA fraud reviews, looking at addresses as well as whether or not the business actually exists and those types of issues. So there are still probably another 150 that are currently under review, so that number of the 5,246 may increase over the coming weeks. Those 5,246 awards total about $336 million. The average award of that group is about $64,000. If you remember, the governor had originally allocated $400 million to Main Street. That difference, the difference between the $336 million and the $400 million, is the result of the grant maximum, the $350,000 grant cap. So that remaining about $60 million will be used in funding the SELF program, the Self-Employed Livelihood Fund. Just for background, among those applicants that had filed for Main Street relief, about 2,000 were denied because they had indicated they were self-employed. In addition, if you remember, Main Street had two phases. There was a pre-qualification phase and the final phase. There were another 2,700 applicants during the pre-qualification phase that had indicated they were self-employed, but the eligibility criteria was known, did not file a final submission. So there was about 4,700 applicants during Main Street application process that indicated they were self-employed, and that really, in SELF recognizes that need, and that's really the basis for SELF. And with respect to the SELF program, this is a very, very similar program to the Main Street program. The big difference, obviously, is that this is for self-employed businesses. By self-employed business, we mean the business has owners only, no employees. A few other differences: the 2019 gross receipts threshold for SELF is $1 million compared to $20 million for Main Street. There is a max SELF grant of $50,000 compared to $350,000 for Main Street. And then SELF has a single application phase, not two. And so this application phase runs for 2 weeks. It's currently open, and it ends on July 17th. With respect to the formula, the SELF formula, again, this is very similar to Main Street. You start with your loss of gross receipts from 2019 to 2020. It's adjusted for other COVID-19 relief funding that has been received. SELF also takes into consideration any unemployment benefits that have been received, but then it applies the same prorated percentage that was used for Main Street, 17.17%. So very similar again. And just to repeat this, I mean, this application period is still open. It ends on July 17th. So please spread the word. There is information available on the Gopher website, the DRA website. There's a program overview with all the eligibility criteria. There are FAQs as well as a link to the applications. That's all. Happy to answer any questions.
Joe, I actually have a question. It's Donnelly. So if somebody was self-employed, meets the $1 million, size of business, and received unemployment, is it a MAP equation where whatever they've received in unemployment, we would only cover the difference between their, say, 2019 earnings? How would that work? I'm just not sure I understand that.
Yeah, good question. So you start with your, what we call the anticipated loss. So this is the difference from 2019 to 2020. You start with that, and then you would subtract your unemployment benefits. So let's say, in 2019 you had $100,000 in gross receipts, in 2020 you have $50,000 in gross receipts, your anticipated loss in that instance is $50,000. You would then subtract any unemployment benefits received. Let's say you have received $10,000 in unemployment benefits, that's both federal and state benefits, that would leave you with $40,000. That $40,000 would then be multiplied by the 17.17%, and that would be your award.
Okay, thank you. That helps.
And, again, it's five stars to ask a question. If I could just add, Sean, Gopher did a lot of advertising with both the Main Street Relief Fund and the SELF Fund as well. Obviously, the SELF Fund is still open, so you might see those digital ads. We have them running in a newspaper websites across the state. We did both print and digital. The governor has mentioned numerous times at the press conferences about these programs. When the governor has also been on WMUR, it's always mentioned. For the Main Street Relief Fund, there were public service announcements that were generously provided by radio stations across the state, on top of just organic social media efforts. The Chambers of Commerce blasted that out. I know government agencies like Department of Business and Economic Affairs sent it out to folks. So these programs have gone far and wide and continue to go far and wide as we try to blanket the state getting news about these opportunities out and about. So I just wanted to put that out there as well. The SELF fund advertising still continues, obviously, since the Main Street Relief Fund program that wrapped up. But there was extensive advertising in both. So hopefully that you've seen that in your local paper or on the mobile versions on their websites and whatnot. So we really tried to blanket the state. So sorry for just mentioning that real fast. And then we have a question from Ben. Go ahead, Ben.
Hi, thank you. And first of all, thanks, that Main Street Relief Fund. I know in the Northern New Hampshire community here felt by a lot of businesses and really came in a nice expedited way so that people that might have been sort of surviving off PPP were sort of balancing that. And I've heard just a lot of positive comments. One question, through a lot of the Zoom calls that I'm involved with, the 501c6 Chamber of Commerce throughout the state, I guess, was not capable of applying for funds. Do we have a sense where that fits? And maybe I'm jumping ahead to the gaps, but I was thinking that since a lot of the chambers are business focused, where did that play into things? And that's my question.
Thanks for your question, Ben. Absolutely. This is Joe. There's a number of programs that we're still working on, working out the details. It's been announced publicly that there's going to be some funding support for Chambers of Commerce specifically, and that's going to be managed by the Department of Business and Economic Affairs. And I know they're working diligently to implement that and work with the chambers. The Department of Business and Economic Affairs happens to be our neighbors. We've kind of set up shop in their office, so we can attest that they are diligently working on that. So there should be news in the coming days about that. But yeah, that's definitely a gap that came up, and we wanted to be responsive to hearing from stakeholders and folks, and we heard from several staff members, but also the chambers directly. So we appreciate the feedback.
Okay, and a great, again, that Main Street Relief Fund, I thought really well-timed and good job with that, for sure.
Thanks for that, sir. Thank you. And we have a question from Scott Mason. Go ahead, Scott.
Thanks, Joe. I'd like to bring up, there was an open letter to the governor and to the Gopher July 6th, and I'll butcher the gentleman's name, Dio Mueno. I apologize if I butchered your name, sir, asking that money be set aside for immigrant and businesses of color that didn't realize or didn't understand what they needed to do in order to apply for grants through the Gopher. I can certainly understand where folks, most of the information I received incoming to my business about, not through Gopher, but from other sources, came through the organizations that I belong to, both, you know, the local chamber and also New Hampshire Farm Bureau. And I can see where folks that own little tiny businesses don't always belong to organizations because they don't have the money to pay, you know, to pay the dues to some of these organizations. And I can understand where some of these folks may have been left behind in this process. And I didn't know whether Gopher was going to take a look at this and see if there's anything they can do. One of the other requests that they made was for a special scholarship fund for students from these families, or I should say from all his term black, brown, and new immigrant student scholarships. And I would suggest that if we do take a look at that, that you sit down and chat with the university system about the current grant guarantee and how that could be utilized to help some of these students.
Thank you for your comments, Scott. You know, we received the letter, and we appreciate any feedback from stakeholders. We definitely, you know, we want to hear as much information out there. We want to hear from folks, you know, out in the public, so we do appreciate that. We're looking into that. I would like to just put a plug out there. I mean, the SELF program is live. It's out there. So I guess something that we would ask for help with, like with any program, is if we can get that out into the different communities. You know, we really want to see numbers go up. You know, we have a healthy amount, but we want to see more people participate. But so thank you for bringing that up, and we will, you know, we have the letter and appreciate the fact that people are reaching out to us, and we want to be responsive.
Joe, I think now's a good time to make another point, too. For folks that need help with language barriers, I think all the members of the board should know that the website that you've created does allow, like many of them, for folks to change the language on the website so that they can read the information in their native language should they be more comfortable with that. I think that's just an important thing for people to know. Sometimes you get caught up on a website and you don't realize all of the bells and whistles that are there, and that one is certainly there, and that could help as well.
Thank you, Dolly. And we have, I've just taken a look at the board. Again, 5-star for the final questions for the Main Street Relief Fund. And again, just one last plug for the SELF program. It's live. Please share it on social media. Share it with your email contacts. Just, you know, we want to have it far and wide. So, oh, and we have a hand raised. From Bill Artinger. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, I just wanted to close by saying that, you know, over the years of my career, I've had opportunities to work with the Department of Revenue Administration, sometimes on the same side, other times adversarially. And I just think it that the representatives from the department and on Gopher, who have put this program together to administer it in a very fast grant way. I know that there are still many details to be worked out, but hats off to the department and all of the people who really tried to move those dollars through very quickly. From what I've seen, that's a pretty fast movement of dollars compared to other states. And great job to the Department of Revenue Administration and all others who worked on that.
Thank you, Bill. And looking at the board, it looks like we are ready to proceed. Switching topics to the Municipal and County COVID-19 Cost Reimbursement Program. Again, that has municipal relief and county relief. And I'm going to pass that over to John Frazier. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Joe. Good afternoon, everybody. So as you probably all know, the governor authorized the allocation and expenditure of $40 million total, $32 million to municipalities, and $8 million to counties to cover eligible COVID-19 related expenses incurred from March 1st through August 31st. And the amounts were allocated based upon the municipality's population as a percentage of the state, and they were figures derived from 2018 population as determined by Office of Strategic Initiative. And if anybody wants to know their population, I can give it to them readily in their hometown. So the program is going along well. There is a grant application that initially had to be completed by the municipalities and counties. And to date, out of the 10 counties and 234 municipalities, or that's 244 total, we've received grant agreements to date of 170. So that's 70% of the counties and municipalities have completed grant agreements. And of that total, the first round of reimbursement, the three reimbursement rounds, there was a June 1st, a July 15th, and a September 15th, those three reimbursement rounds. And 134 towns, cities, and counties sought reimbursement from us for the first round. So that represents 55%. So out of the total 244, 70%, we've received grant agreements from 70% and reimbursement requests from 55%. We, to date, have sent out reimbursements of just under $3.5 million to date. So we're looking for more and more municipalities to submit their grant agreements and to seek reimbursement. The second reimbursement expires on July 15th, and each day I'm seeing more and more emails coming in for those. So by the time this meeting ends, I'll probably have about 15 more emails. So we're really encouraging the municipalities and counties to get the grant agreements in and to seek reimbursement. Initially, the reimbursement periods were a little more restrictive, but we've loosened that up, and we just want to make sure that not everybody waits for the last round to submit their reimbursement request, because there are expenditures that are allowable and there are expenditures that are not allowable. And we really would like to see, each of these entities receive what's available to them, provided they can demonstrate the allowable costs. There are a few interesting things. Initially, expenditures that qualified for FEMA reimbursement, FEMA will reimburse 75% of a number of things, such as PPE and sanitizing and police and fire overtime. So they'll reimburse 75%. Initially, we weren't able to pick up that additional 25%, but subsequent to the entering into the grant agreements, the Treasury loosened those restrictions, so now we can reimburse that additional 25% that FEMA doesn't cover. So that's important, because these municipalities and counties are supposed to first seek reimbursement from FEMA for the first 75%, so we're now able to pick up that 25% for them. That was an added bonus. It's plugging along, the program. It is pretty massive, with 244 entities, we're doing the auditing up front, which is good, so that we're ensuring that their expenditures appear to qualify for reimbursement, so that on the tail end, hopefully there won't be any questions. We've been working with the Municipal Association to make sure that everybody is familiarized with it. Everybody was notified initially, but we just want to make sure that nobody's, nobody's had an oversight. I'm available for any questions.
This is Donnelly. I do have a question, and maybe I missed it. So now that that 25% can be applied for by the municipalities and the counties, there's not like a deadline for filing on municipal and county money similar to what there is on the businesses and some of the other programs, or is there?
There is a deadline, yes. So we can only reimburse for expenditures incurred up till August 31st. This program ends August 31st, and your final reimbursement request has to be submitted by September 15th. So whereas the Coronavirus Relief Fund in the CARES Act extends out till December 30th, this particular program does not extend out that far. It only extends out until August 30th. So,
okay, I think what the ask was, I wanted to make sure that municipalities who are now hearing about being able to apply for that 25%, that they're still able to apply. So it's good to know that the deadline is August. So they could apply tomorrow if they happen to hear or miss the announcement or whatever the case may be, right?
Yes. Yes, okay. And we have, we've loosened the restrictions too. Initially, that first reimbursement period that ended on June 1st, you could only submit for March and April expenses. And if you missed them in that June 1st submission, you were out of luck. So now we've loosened those restrictions. We've waived them so that with your July 15th reimbursement request, you can seek reimbursement for expenses incurred in March and April as well.
Great. So thank you.
Yeah. But just make sure that people don't submit twice for the same expense. That's we've opened it up so that nobody misses out on the opportunity.
Well, we've talked for a long time about double dipping. The communities aren't any different.
Any questions for John? 5-star. Again, 5-star to ask a question. Checking the board. It appears that we don't have any further questions regarding the municipal and county cost reimbursement program. So now I'm going to kick it back over to Sean Thomas for the New Hampshire Agriculture COVID-19 Relief Program. Go ahead, Sean.
Thank you, Joe. So the agriculture program has two parts, a dairy program and a specialty crop producers program. Both of these programs are being administered by the Department of Agriculture. They're really doing a great job. These are very well-designed, thorough programs, and they're moving quickly to operationalize them. The dairy program specifically, that received an allocation of $4 million. I'll call it a monthly program, a monthly automatic program. Automatic meaning there is no application. Monthly meaning checks will be made on a monthly basis. The specialty crops producers program is more or less being paid on a quarterly basis, and there is an application process for that program. So I guess I'll start with the dairy program. The first monthly checks, we expect those will be out the door very, very soon, probably as soon as early next week. This first check will be for the month of April, and then May will follow probably shortly afterwards, and so on and so forth. There's generally, we'll expect about a 45-day lag from the end of the month until when agriculture has the information it needs to make the payments. So this is a program that's based on lost revenue, specifically milk production. It looks at the price actually paid for milk, compares that to the price that was forecasted back in February, It makes some adjustments for insurance and for federal support. And so some of that information does take that 45 days, and that's why there is that lag. But once this program is – once this first check goes out now for the month of April, it should be all downhill from there, I think. On the Specialty Crop Producers Program, the first application period is underway. It is currently opened. It started on June 25th and runs through July 15th. This application period is specifically for the period from March 1st to June 30th. So as I mentioned earlier, this is more or less a quarterly program. So this first period, March 1st to June 30th, then there will be July 1st to September 30th and October 1st to November 30th. So those are the three periods. So this first application period, again, applications due July 15th. Important to note, you cannot apply unless you already registered. There was a separate registration period that ended back on June 22nd. So those who registered can now apply. If they did not register, they cannot apply. And this program is based on COVID-19-related expenses and lost revenues. The specialty crop producers are growers and maple producers largely. So fruit, vegetable, and ornamental plant growers and maple producers, those are the specialty crop producers. And that's the agriculture program. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay. And again, that's 5-star. Again, 5-star to ask the question. Well, seeing none on the board, got a lot of happy farmers out there, so that's great. We're going to kick it over to Lisa with the New Hampshire Child Care Recovery and Stabilization Program. And take it away, Lisa.
Great, thank you. I think we can all agree that ensuring access to safe and quality child care has been crucial to our state's emergency and essential workforce. But now, child care is a vital component to New Hampshire's plan to reopen the economy. The demand for child care is shifting quickly as businesses reopen and parents return to work across multiple industries across the state. So a rapid and intense infusion of resources was identified as a need to stabilize operational budgets of providers to make sure we have a sufficient and qualified workforce and align the system with the industry, employer, and parent needs across the state. So as part of this program, the governor allocated an initial $20 million with $5 million in reserve to support child care programs. This program is being run through DHHS in collaboration with the Department of Education, and those departments have developed a plan to support the immediate needs of the state for child care, while simultaneously looking at the future as part of a holistic early care and education system. And so this process has built upon the work of the New Hampshire's Emergency Child Care Program and Collaborative, which was developed and operationalized during the early stages of the public health emergency. So as businesses reopen and the economy restarts, DHHS and DOE are targeting operational workforce and health and safety supports for the child care system and coordinating those business and family needs. So funds in this are able to be used for promoting health and safety, including training and technical assistance in the areas of infectious disease, early childhood mental and behavioral health, and family support. Funds can be used to ensure financial stability, including specific targeted stabilization and retention grants for the child care industry and family resource centers during this pandemic to cover costs of smaller ratios and group sizes, and to also support infrastructure and coordination of statewide efforts with local regional hubs, and making sure that programs are connected. This funding supports a strategic, aligned, and innovative approach to manage and reopen childcare as the economy reopens. I believe a few days ago, award letters were sent out to a number of programs, and
I have a couple of thank you letters that have crossed our desk, but I know that there's a lot of folks that are working really hard to make sure that our children and our providers are operating in a safe and healthy environment.
Thank you, Lisa. Happy to take some questions. Again, it's five star to raise your hand to ask a question. And we have our first question from Al Letizio Jr. Go ahead, Al.
Hi there. Thank you very much for that update. And I just wanted to clarify because I had received an inquiry from someone in the child care and wondering when the reimbursements would be going out. And it sounds like they are going out. Is that, did I hear that correctly?
I believe that there were letters of notifying applicants of their award status. I believe it was 420 applicants representing 598 programs have received that notification. I don't have information with me right now as to dates of funding going out. It may have gone out. I don't have that information for you. I'm sorry. I can get that.
No problem. That's fine. I appreciate it. The individual who asked me was actually one of our presenters. She was Donna Hazier was asking on behalf of her organization, which is a group of these providers. They were just, I think they had not received funds, and they were just a little bit concerned. Some of them were real concerned about their own finances with everything going on. So I did direct her over to Joe's office, and presumably there's been a contact made or there's been at least some progress report given back, and hopefully if that is not the case, then it happens soon. Thank you.
Absolutely, and I do know that the department is committed to working as quickly as possible for very long hours on the weekends as well in processing these, so we do appreciate it. And I know they've worked with providers and continue to communicate with them because, you know, obviously everything is urgent, but we also want to make sure that we get it right. So I will make sure to pass that along, but I just wanted to make sure that folks know how hard the department is working on these efforts.
I thank you so much, and just want to echo what Bill Ardinger said. You guys are doing a tremendous job, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Looking at the board, again, five stars, ask a question. Very good, okay. Proceeding to the next program is the New Hampshire Food Bank Grant Program. And I'm going to kick that over to Sean. Go ahead, Sean.
This one is pretty straightforward. I will keep it very, very short and sweet. You may remember the governor allocated $5 million to the food bank, $2 million now, $3 million being held in reserve. The issue here, obviously, is the increased food cost with all the additional needs and the supply issues. So the food bank will be reporting to Gopher on a monthly basis, and using this information, we will make some of that reserve money available as needed. And so that's really where we are at this point. The $2 million has been issued, and we will keep an eye on whether or not we need to go to the reserve.
Great. Thank you, Sean. And again, that's five star to ask the question. Again, that's five star. Okay, and again, before we move on to the next topic, just because we've had a few other people that have joined us on the call, this is a duly noticed meeting of the Stakeholder Advisory Board. This call is being recorded, and the meeting is being conducted in a manner compliant with RSA 91A. And again, it's five star to raise your hand, and we'll switch gears now to Lisa, who will chat about the New Hampshire Housing Relief Fund. Go ahead, Lisa.
Thank you, Joe. So this is a fund that is $35 million fund with $20 million initially allocated and $15 million being held in reserve for rent stabilization and housing support. The impact on households unable to pay rent due to COVID-19 goes beyond the risk to their housing security. It can impact those individuals. It can impact small landlords and other property owners. And it certainly can have a public health impact on our families and individuals. So the governor set up this fund. The Department of Health and Human Services has worked with the New Hampshire's five community action program agencies to set this up at an incredible pace. The applications went live on June 30th, and I'll talk a little bit about what they are for, what the applications are for. This is designed to keep people from losing their housing and to secure or maintain permanent housing. And so there's two components, although one is really in two parts. There are one-time assistance grants. Those are to be used for households that just need a little bit of help due to a COVID-19 deficiency with their funds in the household. So it could be for past due rent from April 2020 forward. It could be to household-related expenses that impact their ability to maintain their housing. It could impact their ability to pay their rent. So that grant is not to be higher than $2,500, and again, has to be a COVID-related cost or expense. And it's targeted to households that will be able to maintain their household without assistance once they have that one-time payment. The second part is a short-term rental relief program. That can be used to for past due rent that was not paid due to a COVID-19 related inability to pay, as well as ongoing rental assistance on a short-term basis using progressive engagement with the CAP agencies. And that rental assistance decreases over time as the households regain stability. So that's one part. The other part is the ability for first month's rent and ongoing short-term rental assistance to assist with initial costs to transition working households out of shelters and into permanent into permanent housing. So all three components of this, the one-time grant and the short-term rental assistance, is coupled with regional case management services. And that's to ensure that households can be connected with the appropriate services as defined by the household and the CAP agencies. So I have just one quick statistic. In the first 6 days of the application being set up, CAP agencies have received 2,500 requests for applications. So that's not as of today. That was as of a couple of days ago. So there certainly is a great deal of interest in this program, and we will be monitoring the impact of it as we go forward. I'm happy to take any questions.
Again, that's 5-star to raise your hand. Again, 5-star. Okay. And we're going to go ahead. Scott, we have our first question from Scott Mason. Go ahead, Scott.
Sorry about that. I was a little slow. I just want to make sure I heard right. You said you had 2,500 applications from the different CAP organizations, or is that total on all rental units?
So that's the applications are being run through the CAP programs, and they have a website that I should have mentioned, which is, let me just pull that up, it's New Hampshire CAP, I believe. I'll pull that up in a second. The CAP agencies have received individuals asking for assistance under this program. They've received 2,500 requests for applications to participate in this program. So, I don't have a breakdown as to whether or not that's folks looking for the one-time support versus the short-term rental program.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Joe. This is Donnelly. I just want to take a minute. I wasn't quick enough under childcare, but I just want to mention two things so it's out in the public. I think everybody knows that CAP stands for Community Action Partnership. just want to point out that Southern New Hampshire Services, which is the entity that I serve as the executive director for, is one of the five entities in the state that is dispersing these funds on behalf of the state contract. Housing funds were something we had done prior to COVID. It's been a long time thing that Community Action has done. I know we talked about it when Dean Christian presented, but I just wanted to put that out there. And the second thing that I wanted to put out there is our agency also provides child care to more than 630 children in our two counties that we serve, in Hillsborough and Rockingham. And so we also did apply for child care funds. I wasn't involved in the application. I had staff do that work, and I just wanted to make sure that I was publicly disclosing that as a member of this advisory board. Thank you.
Thank you, Donnelly. And I think Lisa wanted to mention one more thing.
I'm so sorry I didn't have it at my fingertips. I just want to make sure that folks are aware of the website, which is capnh.org, and there's wonderful information on that website. And if you know of folks that don't have easy access to the internet, 211, they can dial 211 and they can get information about the program as well. And you can always, of course, check our Gopher webpage, which has links to the capnh.org page as well.
And for folks at home and on the board, the COVID expenditures tab, just if you want to follow along, you can see the different programs. And again, there's a lot more details, and we're kind of given the high points here. So, because otherwise the meeting, I think, would last into the late hours of the evening. And we have a, now turning it over to a question from Bill Arginger. Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you, Joe. Lisa, I've been, you know, concerned about an aspect of the rental maintenance program and support program that the tenants have access to good advice, good counseling, and that New Hampshire Legal Assistance provides that. But, you know, this could be quite a surge as tenants are applying for these programs, receiving the benefit of the programs through CAP agencies, other things like that. What kind of work is being done to ensure that, number one, there is a contact information, exchange of information, going on with New Hampshire Legal Assistance, and number two, that New Hampshire Legal Assistance has the resources available to make sure that they can assist tenants stay in housing arrangements. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a great question. And I'm embarrassed to say that before my drive home last night, I did not know that this program was going to be featured on NHPR, the exchange program. But on that program, there was a representative from Housing Action New Hampshire, from a CAP agency, and from the New Hampshire Legal Assistance. So they are certainly coordinating and providing information. I believe that NHLA has information, even though its offices are closed. On their doors. And that program was a wonderful opportunity to hear about a lot of questions and answers. The CAP agencies have just a robust ability to answer and provide information, but New Hampshire Legal Assistance has obviously been getting the word out about this program and will continue to do so, and monitor and make sure that people have the services that they need.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Bill. With that, I'm looking at the board again. 5-star. And just want to check if any board members have joined. If Jim, Nancy, or Jeff joined the call, if you could just maybe if you didn't use the speaker code, press 5-star, and we'd be able to find you. Just wanted to put that out there because we want to recognize your attendance to make sure that you're able to ask a question. With that, we're going to turn it over to Nancy Smith for a quick discussion about the New Hampshire Nonprofit Emergency Relief Fund.
Hello again. This is Nancy. So this is going to be very quick because we are
relying very heavily on our contract with a wonderful group who has a lot more knowledge than Gopher about New Hampshire nonprofits, made up of the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, the Center for Nonprofits, and the Community Development Finance Authority. We contracted with them to administer the application process for the nonprofits. They had that application process. It was open for 2 weeks. I believe it closed right before the 4th of July. I'm not remembering the date off the top of my head, but that application process was open for 2 weeks. They did a lot of publicity and got word out to a lot of the nonprofits about the availability of that program. They were frequently asked questions that consortium granted to try and answer the questions that they thought would come up about it. Those were up on their website as well as ours. And my last information from the Charitable Foundation on the number of applications received was that they had gotten slightly over 600 applications in that process. The program calls for them to go through and evaluate those applications and then to make recommendations to Gopher and the governor for awards to be made. So we are eagerly anticipating receiving the recommendations from the Charitable Foundation and their partners on the awards to be made from that $60 million fund.
Excellent. So Joe had to step out for a moment, and he's just coming in back right now. But are there any questions for Nancy? Okay, so no
great.
Questions.
Very good. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you, Lisa. Now we're going to turn it back to Lisa for the New Hampshire Safer Spaces COVID-19 Shelter Modification Program. Go ahead, Lisa.
Great. Thank you, Joe. A theme certainly has emerged in our work here. There are a lot of challenges for a lot of businesses, families, individuals, but certainly the needs of New Hampshire's vulnerable citizens have become intensified, and that includes individuals experiencing homelessness. So New Hampshire homeless shelters don't have the resources to effectively accommodate physical distancing between people when shelters are at capacity. Some initial funding was available early on in the pandemic, and the weather was still quite cold, to address those needs through operating temporary secondary shelters. But that need still remains as we head into the fall, and we'll start to see an increased number of folks using the shelters. So the governor authorized an allocation of $15 million of flex funds to support those kinds of modifications and expansion to help mitigate the spread during the COVID-19 pandemic. So this is going to allow shelters to be able to adapt their physical spaces, pay for increased operating costs that are associated with social distancing, and to potentially develop alternative sites to accommodate the needs of the population that's being served. And this will help to reduce the likelihood of ongoing transmission during this public health emergency. So this plan is in its early stages, but I'm happy to take any questions.
Great, thank you. And again, that five-star, if you'd like to ask a question again, five-star. Okay. Proceeding forward, back to Lisa, the Higher Education COVID-19 Response Fund, which includes the New Hampshire Public Higher Education System Grant Program and the New Hampshire Safer Scholars COVID-19 Campus Modification Program. That's a lot there. So turning it back to Lisa, go ahead.
Thank you. I'll make this very quick. This is a fund of total of $15 million, with $10 million going to the University System of New Hampshire and $5 million going to the Community College System of New Hampshire. And these are to cover eligible COVID-19-related expenses, such as building out infrastructure to strengthen the ability to deliver remote online learning when necessary, and to have the ability for greater social distancing on campus. The funds can also be used for testing of COVID-19 and contact tracing of students, faculty, and staff, as well as PPE, enhanced cleaning, planning for isolation and care of those that have become infected, and increased staffing to have longer lab hours so that there's less students have to be using the facilities at a particular time. So I'm happy to take any questions about this grant program.
Right. And again, that's five star to ask the question. Okay. Seeing none, Donnelly, I guess the next thing, those are kind of the announced programs. I'm sorry, Lisa, did I jump the gun? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
One more that I'll be
very
even
good.
Quicker with.
Great.
And I probably should have combined it. My apologies. The governor announced a $10 million fund to assist private nonprofit colleges and universities for similar expenses that I just talked about. So I'll leave it at that and stop taking over Joe's time.
No, it's fine. It's fine. So there's a lot there. Again, website content is added and updated every day. There's a lot out there. We understand. Feel free to explore the website. There's a ton of information out there. So now, Don Lee, it's okay, just to kind of stay on topic, is it okay if I go to skip C for a moment and go right to D, which is kind of the programs in the works or in development?
I think so, because the applications process and the spending amounts to date, some of that has been talked about as you've gone through, so if there's anything we've missed, that'd be fine. But, yeah, please carry on.
So, and then we'll a few programs, and again, we don't have a lot yet that we're ready to roll out because we're working with, and again, this has been a team partnership with different agencies in the state, different entities. You know, we're working with folks everywhere trying to find, the best path forward, recognizing the goal, the recommendations put forth by this board to work with existing entities. So we're working things out. We just don't want to put any pressure on folks as they're working. But I know, one program is the New Hampshire General Assistance and Preservation Fund, or the GAP Fund. I know the governor has mentioned that several times publicly, and that's going to be a partnership between us and the Business Finance Authority. So we're looking for that. Looking forward to that. The New Hampshire Invest in the Future Fund, and that's the through the New Hampshire Internet Crimes Against Children, and so it'll be the New Hampshire Internet Crimes Against Children COVID-19 Emergency Program, programs to support community youth, working with the Governor's Youth Council, looking at issues of in the veterans community. Regarding homelessness, mental health, community centers, such as like the VFW halls, American Legions, Disabled American Veterans, and also just general services. And then also we're looking at mental health, substance abuse support as well with different partners. So we're really trying to hit all the different areas of the state that have been impacted by COVID-19. So those are kind of some programs that are in development that, again, I'd encourage you just to monitor the website because something could be put on overnight and then you'll see the program overview and all that information. So we have a lot of really great partners in this process. We're continuing to add to that partnership team. So those are kind of kind of what we're working on currently, and more is added each day, so there's never a dull moment here at the Gopher office. So with that, I guess just, you know, mentioning the Part C, you know, we chatted a little bit about the different applications in the different programs. The SELF program is very healthy in terms of the applications coming in, so we'd like to see that go up. And it just it was just wanted to double check the number of the SELF program. We have over 4,300, so that's exciting of applications. So let's keep them coming. So I just wanted to check with Sean there on the number because it's going up as we speak. We can see the numbers come in. And so in terms of, you know, we're talking about the $1.25 billion when we first had our first conversation, and that's within just the CARES Act flex funds that we work with here. That's not mentioning the other federal funding sources that come into the state through various entities. But these are just, again, the flex funds that Gopher has direct kind of jurisdiction over. We have $970,147,000 expended, allocated, or committed. Did I say that right? It's a wild number, and it's very exciting. So that's when you kind of add up a lot of these programs. So for those of you who are doing math in your heads right now, I'll do it for you. That means that there is $279,853,000 remaining, meaning not expended, allocated, or committed. So again, that's you know, a lot of work, a lot of programs, a lot of partnerships, and so that's direct money getting out in communities all across the Granite State. So that's incredibly exciting, and we're really happy that we're moving quickly, but we're moving, you know, with again with good partners and good processes as well. So, sorry, Donna, go ahead.
To make sure that that we're clear, I think it's clear from what you said. But when you say expended, allocated, and committed, the example that I'll use just to make sure I understand is $400 million into the Main Street Relief Fund, $300 plus, you know, given out. You're still counting that full $400 in this $970, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Just wanted to make sure.
Absolutely. And we have, like, with John with the reimbursement programs, John Fraser with the municipal and county, you know, more dollars get out the door every day with, you know, we love getting those reimbursements. So, you know, towns and cities, please get them in. You know, our partners with the on the nonprofit relief fund, you know, those applications end at the end of this month, and that's exciting. So that's more money out the door. And again, after the SELF program closes, that's more money out the door. And, you know, we're working quickly, early mornings, late nights, weekends. You know, we have really, really great partners. As Bill mentioned, you know, DRA, especially Main Street Relief Fund, the SELF Fund. You know, lots still to do, and we're just trying to work diligently and make that happen.
Great. So I think that gets us, unless there are other questions from members, which we can wait and see, that would get us to any Treasury guidance update as your last item, right?
I'm sorry, Donnelly, could you say that again?
I said, unless there are other questions from members, the last thing under your presentation is any Treasury guidance update.
Yeah, so looking at the board, Donnelly, we don't appear to have any questions. So with that, I guess I'll turn it over to Nancy Smith for a little update on the guidance we received from Treasury.
Hello again. It's actually been a fairly busy couple of weeks with new information coming in from Treasury in a number of ways. One significant one is a four-page letter we received on July 2nd from the Treasury Inspector General, because under our section of the CARES Act, the Treasury Inspector General was given the responsibility to audit, monitor, and conduct recoupment as necessary related to inappropriate uses of these CARES Act funds. We received instructions in that letter from the Treasury Inspector General regarding our reporting and record retention requirements. And if the board would like to have copies of these documents, we're happy to provide them afterwards. I won't get into detail on that. Our first report, which is an interim report, is due on July 17th, so they only gave us like 15 days to get this initial report done, but it's at a very high level reporting on money out the door so far in 8 different categories. By September, they are going to have a reporting portal, and we'll have to do detailed quarterly reporting. So we're getting our processes set up to be sure that we have that. On the record retention field, this is part of why we have built into, particularly into our agreements where we're giving people money based on anticipated losses. We're building in reporting requirements because there are requirements that the state maintain and have supporting documentation for the allowability of all of the awards that it makes. The only other thing of note on the record retention is the Treasury OIG imposed a 5-year record retention requirement rather than the more normal 3-year under the usual Code of Federal Regulations. So that was one significant occurrence. The Treasury Department itself issued updated guidance on June 30th. In that document, they added, I think, 3 paragraphs focused mainly on explaining more about when a cost is incurred. Most significant in that is that they were very clear that either the performance, and this kind of goes to the prior discussion about broadband, but that the performance or the delivery of the goods or services has to have occurred within the period, which is March 1st through December 30th. There's a little bit of wiggle room based on their additions that if the work was done before the 30th, but you don't get the invoice till January, we can still get the invoice paid as long as the work was performed during the period. So that is the Treasury Department June 30th guidance update. There were 2 updates to the Treasury Frequently Asked Questions since you last met. At least I think they were since you last met on June 24th and then another one on July 8th. The June 24th one added quite a bit of material. That's the one that, as John Fraser mentioned, confirmed that we could make the 25% FEMA match. So that was one of the most significant things in the additions to the frequently asked questions. The one on July 8th just answered one question that was really more related to what state payroll expenses might be allowable.
Great. Thank you, Nancy. Any questions? 5-star. Again, 5-star. Great. Great. Well, just double-checking the board. Donnelly, I think that concludes our program, our presentation on the programs and items A through E. So I'd like to turn that over to you, and thank you for allowing us to present.
Well, thank you, everybody. You did a very thorough job, and I think that many of us have been on the website looking, but it's really nice to put some additional context around the work that's being done. I can't imagine how many moving parts you are all trying to keep track of, questions that come up, you know, what needs to be done, and, you know, I'm very impressed with the work to date. So thank you again for sharing more information with all of us. The next item on our agenda is discussions regarding further recommendations. Are there things that any of the board members think that we should be discussing? Are there things that the Gopher staff, Joe, I'm looking to you, that you need us to do more work on, dig a little deeper in something, any of that kind of work that we could do to assist? I take very seriously that our job is to try to get your office the information that you need so that you can make the best recommendations possible on the work that you're doing. So I'll open it up to you if you want to respond to that, and open it up, please, to members of the board who would like to put anything on the table, whether there are gaps in things that we see or are hearing. I think it would be helpful to have a discussion. So, Joe, I'll let you respond to that if you'd like, or ask if there are questions of other members.
Perfect. Well, Donnelly, thanks so much. I mean, we would really love to hear from board members, too. I mean, if you feel as though there's a gap or something we should look into, you know, that would be, I think, really something very helpful for us.
Okay, so are there any board members that would like to put something on the table for discussion?
And Donnelly, we had a few hands raised, but the first from Holly. Go ahead, Holly.
Thank you very much. I'm on the New Hampshire COVID Alliance support team that supports the long-term care facilities, and they're anticipating a second surge in the long-term care facilities come September, October. Is there money set aside, or is it possible to put a reserve aside for the long-term care stabilization fund to help maintain staffing come the second possible surge?
Hi, Holly. This is Joe. So we're, as I mentioned, you know, there is expended, allocated, or committed funds of almost $280 million. You know, we're constantly trying to rework and understand, you know, where future needs are. So that's definitely something that we're trying to obviously work in the right now, but look at the horizon as well. And so we are, that's something definitely to consider. And we certainly hope that there's no second surge. We want to hope for the best, but we need to plan for the future and make sure that, you know, that we're ready if something were to, heaven forbid, happen.
That was my only question. Thank you.
Donnelly, we have a question from Michelle. Go ahead, Michelle.
Hi, thank you. Well, I have two questions. My first one is somewhat similar to the one Holly just asked, not specific to long-term care, but yes, there's a lot of concern that there will be another spike or our second wave. And so I didn't know, you know, from a policy perspective, is it the plan to try to keep some of these funds until fall in the event that there is something, or is Gopher looking to identify and sort of extend all of these up front?
Certainly, we are certainly definitely saving some funds for the fall. You know, I think it's important. But also just adding, you know, we are keeping a watchful eye on Washington, D.C., and we hope that, you know, there are certain limitations on these funds. And, you know, we are striving for, you know, 110% compliance on programs, but there are gaps. You know, as we mentioned in the beginning, I never thought I would say 1.25 is not enough, 1.25 billion. I think, you know, I mentioned that a few times in the first few calls. There's certainly so much need. So we're keeping an eye on D.C., and we want to balance, you know, we need to strike a balance between saving for the fall and not having money left on the table December 30th, because that just goes back to the federal government. So as we do go back and look at other programs, you know, we announced a lot of ups to, you know, on programs. So some programs, you know, don't hit exactly. You know, we're not trying to, you know, hit a number, but we're budgeting to make sure that our partners have the ability to get the job done. So, you know, when we go back through, we are finding some dollars here and there that aren't spent, and what's great is that we just recirculate that back into the not expended, allocated, or committed. So, you know, we're really trying to strike a balance, you know, and definitely, you know, we'd love to, you know, hear from board members on their thoughts. You know, you all have your ears to the ground, and, you know, we'd really appreciate just any more information that you could provide us.
Well, we don't have a crystal ball either, but I mean, from the healthcare sector, we certainly feel that there is going to be a second wave. You know, I'm in a college community, and I'm working very closely with the university about safe return of students, but that certainly increased our risk substantially. So there is great concern for that.
Michelle, I was just going to add, and Joe, that my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, is that some of these dollars that are being applied for, also people are asking as it relates to business continuity, being ready for if it happens again either this year or a year from now, you know, making changes in their facilities or their approach or what their needs might be to be better prepared. Certainly not all of the dollars, and it certainly wouldn't be something for when it happens. For example, the staff costs that you may have to account for in another surge or that type of thing, but other ways of, you know, broadband's a great example. The work that's being done there is not only for what's happening right now, but it will shore things up. Is the goal for should something happen again and kids need to be pulled out of school or businesses need, you know, better bandwidth and that sort of thing. So I think it's a combination of efforts and of planning and immediacy.
So my second question had to do with the question here on the agenda about are there gaps? And you know, as I listened to your report about new programs that are in development, for example, you know, Internet Crimes Against Children, you know, certainly wasn't on our radar. Makes sense as we've got children at home online more with remote, you know, they were doing remote learning. Now who knows what they're doing. So are you finding that there are businesses or various sectors trying to apply for some of the buckets of grants available now and getting turned down because they don't qualify? I mean, would that be one way to identify if there are some gaps?
I'm not sure, I guess, how to best address that question. I would say that we're just trying to be responsive to when we hear of new ideas. I mean, with the Internet Crimes Against Children, you know, that's a governmental entity where, you know, we heard from stakeholders that, you know, that's an additional need. So just, you know, the goal is just to try to be responsive. I know, like, the GAP fund covers a lot of different areas in which we've heard to try and provide an option, you know,
for folks that may need, that option, I guess. And so we're just trying to, again, balance the needs of acting quickly and, you know, planning for fall. And so there's just so many considerations that go in. So, and again, we just really appreciate you all's thoughts as we try to, you know, move along in this process.
Thank you.
Donnelly, we have a few more questions. We have Scott with a question. Go ahead, Scott.
A couple of questions. It seems to me that the vast majority of the money that we've committed is to pay for the damages already occurred. And with the exception of the broadband program and then the program on increasing our ability to deal with the homeless, we haven't really invested much money in areas to help us increase our ability to withstand any future COVID-19 type issues. When we've granted money to businesses now, we do it based on their loss, and then it's up to that business, and each business is in a different financial situation, whether they need that money to cover losses to keep the doors open, or whether they have the financial wherewithal to take that money and invest in their business to harden the business for the future. Would it make sense for us to start to take testimony again from different people as far as what they need to do to harden their businesses and harden their organizations going forward, and look at that testimony before we look at how to spend the rest of the money that we have?
I think Joe and I are trying to figure out which one of us is supposed to answer that. So I think from my perspective, everything's on the table, Scott. One of the reasons that we're, meeting again today is to try to determine if there are things that we should do like that. I think it might be a little bit early to do it differently, so to speak. I don't know, Joe. I'm not sure that that's the answer that you're looking for, Scott. Or maybe I didn't understand exactly what you were asking.
No, I'm not really asking a question. I guess what I'm putting on the table is that through our process, we really did not gather a lot of information from the testimony as far as what needs to happen to harden us.
I may be using the wrong word here, but
to harden us looking into the future of future issues with COVID-19, are there other things like expanding our homeless shelters that we need to be doing? Have we got to a point where we're okay with the number of ventilators we need? Are we okay with the number of isolation units that we have? All of these things and look at, try to look at some of the testimony and stuff like that. What happens with child care? Do we have what we need going forward with the child care system, or are there things that we need to be looking at beyond day-to-day survival?
So I think there are a couple of ways to look at that. Now that I really think I understand what you're saying, is that there are, as I said earlier when Michelle asked her questions, there are different groups that are doing that as part of this round. As you know, in the beginning when we were talking about this, we were talking about there were three components, right? The immediacy, the recovery, and the preparation for the future. So I know, for example, as I had mentioned, that different groups, so let's say, for instance, the homeless shelters, they are looking at and have received money for spacing people better, doing physical changes to their facilities, both for right now as well as into the future when they had some of the home, the shelters had to be emptied because they couldn't accommodate the separation that would keep people safe. I know that some of the child cares, based on the reopening, are looking at how could we have our classrooms be set up differently so that we could keep children longer or are able to help if there's a surge again. But I do think that as we move through the summer and these funds are being dispersed and businesses are catching a breath, that there may be more information that we hear that we can come back to and say, so with these funds that haven't been spent, could we look to opening it up for people in that sense? I don't know if that helps.
That's fine by me. I'm trust me, I'm not looking for another meeting this week. But I just want to make sure that we don't leave issues on the table that need to be addressed.
Fair enough. Joe, other questions?
Yeah, we have a question from Ben.
Hi, thanks. Sort of a little bit of a follow-up to what Scott was mentioning, and really my sphere of neighborhood here is a lot to do with hospitality and what we are sort of defining as the new normal, and people are adapting to opening. And I think everyone has taken sort of a short-term approach to trying to get restaurants open and a lot of hospitality and things and coming out of a difficult spring. But it kind of follows up on the question that all of the meetings I've had recently with chambers and is now, okay, we've kind of gotten this far. We've had some relief. We're all sort of getting by with where we're at this point. But I think where the planning now is shifting to 6 to 12 months to saying new normal protocols for hospitality, restaurants, ski resorts, weddings that are basically drying up and moving to next year functions. And I think the initial work of this group is amazing, and it's really had a critical piece in the recovery and sort of the stopping the bleeding right away there. But I do think there's going to be a longer range impact, and I'm just talking about the areas that are in my world where many other things mentioned, like healthcare and childcare and all the other areas, I'm sure are as important. But and I know that we've used a lot of the funds, but just it does seem like we're on about a 12-month road here ahead to continue adapting to the new normal, and that's going to obviously continue. We're going to continue to hear from people, I think, soon, and people talking about a resurgence. I think whether there is or not, I think everybody's starting to get to the mode of, well, this is the world we're going to be in for at least 12 months. So anyway, not a rah-rah speech here by any means, but that's just what I'm hearing as everybody's trying to now figure out, okay, we've gotten this far. How do we get to the next 12 months? And it may be important for us to reconvene when we hit, say, September, once we get through this summer season and hear how things, you know, the results of that. And I think that's all I had to say.
Thanks, Ben. Joe, anybody else on the...
Yeah, Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Kathleen. Go ahead, Kathleen.
Thanks, Joe. And thank you for this presentation and all of the work. I think it has helped us better understand some of the evolving programs in addition to the ones that have been announced and really rolled out. I kind of came to the meeting with some questions, which you addressed a bit in terms of those gaps. One of the things that I think about from the gaps from the nonprofit, for example, for the nonprofit organizations was we do continue to hear from organizations that were not C3s, like the chambers and other organizations, but it sounds like some of those are being worked through, as well as like veterans organizations, many of which are nonprofits but not C3s. Just continuing on that vein and somewhat piggybacking on what Michelle had said, I think as the grants are announced from the Nonprofit Relief Fund, as well as the healthcare stabilization and the other doors for nonprofits, the SUDs and others, there may be other gaps that become clearer. I know that the Gopher's office was really rolling things out quickly and in quick succession. We were trying to get people to the right place, you know, like childcare organizations, or to go to childcare, not to the Nonprofit Relief Fund. And it seems to me that there may need to be some analysis after those first rounds of applications to see if there are other gaps in the social service and nonprofit arena, between those programs. So that was one thought about gaps. And then the other thing I think that has been touched upon a couple of times by different folks is related to the future forward-looking impacts. And we are challenged by the CARES Act determination that funds must be expended by 12/30. I think that has shortened people's time frame in thinking about what they need to do, and it's been very much focused on the relief. But it is possible that there may be some other ways that we could build some of that infrastructure, you know, like the housing groups have done or the Housing Stabilization Fund has done. So I just wanted to echo what other people had said in that area.
Thanks, Kathleen. You know, Jill, that point's come up a couple of times about applications. So if somebody applied and were denied, or, they can't seem to fit in any one of the categories. I know that I can't even imagine how you'd all have time to take a look at some of those, but if there's a way to identify some of those things, which I think, frankly, from what I can see by the programs and the works, it's one of the things that you're trying to respond to. The SELF program is a perfect example of that. But it may be worthwhile to see if there's a way that we can figure some of that out rather than anecdotally for those of us that are hearing from people that don't feel like they fit in a bucket. But, maybe we can give some thought to that over the next several weeks to determine if there's anything else that would help indicate what those gaps might be.
Donnelly, that would be great. I mean, we're trying to be there's so much information coming in, and we're just trying to, and we'd appreciate the board's thoughts. You know, when you hear those stories and those cases, we have developed really good partnerships. I know DRA has been working so diligently on the appeals process, the Main Street Relief Fund, working with folks. I know with the SELF program, we responded to some folks who, wanted to see some tweaks. We were responsive to that. The GAP fund is being created to help address, those kind of, those gaps. If board members have an idea, feel free to reach out. Because we only know if there's a problem by having someone reach out. So, and we try to be as responsive as possible, like I mentioned, to the web inquiry and the email that we have set up. So we're public and out there. So, we definitely would like to hear if there are gaps, and we'll work to address them.
Thanks. That sounds great. If there's a role that you think that we could play, aside from the one that you've just described, something comes up, by all means, let me know. Okay, who else might be signed up to say something? Anybody else?
We have a hand raised from Bill. Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you very much. And I think you know, these comments are really good. As I've said before to this group, you know, I've had the pleasure of working with the Business Finance Authority and continue to do that. James Key Wallace, the executive director of the BFA, is working on identifying GAP recipients. Among them, these include things like venues, whether it's, minor league baseball in Manchester, Capital Center for the Arts, these larger organizations that may not have qualified for GAP funds, for the Main Street program or the nonprofit program that exists. And I think that James Key Wallace may be someone, Donnelly, at some point. I think he may be presenting to the lab group on what he's seeing as possible GAP areas, but I think that's important. And he is moving ahead. And some of the concerns about building capacity, the CARES Act guidance now clarifies that loans can be made. If they're repaid in the future, they have to be returned to the federal government. But I think loans provide an avenue to really establish very preferential, terms for businesses that need it and allow some flexibility to extend the period where the borrower is using those funds to build what Scott has called, capacity to deal with future challenges of a second COVID crisis. I think that's very important. I would just like to emphasize again that I think housing, and I know we've got Dean on the phone, housing is absolutely critical in what, people are beginning to perceive as going to be a continuing adverse impact on our state and its most vulnerable citizens over the next, period of years, frankly. And anything we can do to strengthen our homeless, capacity to provide homeless, shelter for citizens who, are evicted from their current housing arrangement or otherwise don't have access to housing arrangements is vital. And Joe, I think that means, strengthening not just the housing shelters themselves. And I think the CARES Act, as long as we're really focusing on building capacity to address housing needs in a transformed way that COVID requires, like a little bit more isolation, capacity, independent capacity. We have to focus the remaining resources, I think, on housing using expertise like Dean's organization and expertise like New Hampshire Legal Assistance. We've got to get a focus on that because otherwise I think we're going to be, caught, in situations like with Michelle's industry and area, hospitals. We've got to have capacity ready for the second wave and continuing adverse impact. So I'm thinking that, as one member, I think, to Scott's point, let's build the capacity in those areas so our citizens, can receive the necessary services when they need to receive it. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Joe, any other members?
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Scott. Go ahead, Scott.
I would just like to bring back up something Bill said much earlier in the meeting today, and he did it much better than I possibly can. But I would like to thank the members of GOFA for their hard work here. It is absolutely amazing what you folks have been able to do in such a short period of time and get so much money out to citizens and businesses in the state of New Hampshire. And you've done it, I think you've done it, just an incredible job. And I personally would like to thank the work that you folks have done. On a minor point, going back to some of the groups, do you know whether or not if a company identified their business structure as a co-op, did that kick them out? Were co-ops able to participate in Main Street?
So, Scott, I'd have to look at the recipients, but there was no function on there to identify themselves as a co-op.
Okay.
The menu of questions included, are you a for-profit business? I'm trying to go through the items. Have you heard any issues? But again, and real fast, just thank you for your kind words, and really appreciate that. We'll communicate that to the whole team here. But I'm looking at our to Sean on the Main Street Relief Fund, and I'm not sure if we've gotten that question yet.
I apologize. I have not had any complaints from anybody on co-ops. I was just thinking through different structures and wondering whether or not if those were able to, receive funding or not. I will check with a couple and get back in touch with you if there's any issues that I find.
Great. And I guess, the initial kind of test, I guess, is, if they are for-profit, then they should be in, I would say, good shape. A lot of folks have been notified on the Main Street, and by a lot of folks, I mean almost everybody has been notified regarding the Main Street Relief Fund. DRA is working with a few businesses on the appeals process, and that is only taking a little while just because, if people are emailing documents back and forth and whatnot, recognizing the holiday weekend and whatnot. So the appeals process closed July 2nd, and I know we just have a few more businesses that are going through that process now, so we're hoping and anticipating the Main Street Relief numbers to go up, which is great.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you again for your kind words, sir. Appreciate it. Donnelly, it appears, again, 5-star, but the board is not showing any further hands raised.
Okay, great. Thank you, Joe. Appreciate the discussion we're having. Is there any other business that members would like to raise? Okay. I think you would say something, Joe, if there was something.
The board isn't showing any hands raised.
Okay, great. So the next item on our agenda is our next meeting date to be determined. Based on the conversation today, we have a couple of ideas of something that might make sense maybe in early August for us to touch base again, unless something comes up sooner. But it might be a good idea to have somebody like BFA or DRA or New Hampshire Charitable or Kathleen Shop, the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits, maybe talk to us a little bit about, how things have played out from their perspective. I think I'll maybe connect with you, Joe. We can maybe talk that through and see if there's something that makes sense that we might be able to help with to hear from them. So other than that, any of the members, please feel free to email myself or Joe if something comes up that you think that we should be aware of or put on a meeting agenda, and we'll look at whether it makes sense to connect in early August. Other than that, I'm not sure that there's any other business to come before us today. Anybody? Going once? Twice? All right. With that, we'll call the meeting adjourned. Thank you, everybody. And again, we appreciate all your time from the Gopher office. I know you have a lot on your plate.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Have a good
summer.
Thank
you.
All righty.
Bye.
Thank you for joining a duly noticed meeting of the Stakeholder Advisory Board. This meeting has been recorded, and we will conclude the recording looking at the time. It is 4:19 p.m. Have a great day.